Another surprise move delays a final vote on Jacksonville's pension problem. We'll take your calls just ahead, and good Wednesday morning. Hope traffic wasn't too bad for you out there today. Live from Studio 5, you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in this morning. I'm Melissa Ross. First Coast Connect, always live on the radio. And now make sure to catch our daily podcast. It's on iTunes. Catch the show anytime. Just ahead, we'll take your calls on the pension crisis and the road ahead as we speak with UNF President John Delaney and UNF's Mick Hallett, too. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, Going Green profiles horticulture as a special speaker comes to the Cummer Museum of Art and Gardens, plus why the Blood Alliance needs your help and all about their unique partnership this month. All of that ahead. But first this morning, another delay seems to be in the works to resolve Jacksonville's pension issue. In a surprise move this week, Jacksonville City Council President Clay Yarbrough delayed a final vote on pension reform legislation that was actually set for tonight. He says new concerns about the deal have recently surfaced. What to do about Jacksonville's mounting pension debt has become a pressing financial concern and one that has surfaced as an issue in the city's mayor's race. Some have called for a slight tax increase to address the pension obligation. Mayor Brown is asking JEA to put some skin in the game to help pay the pension debt down. It's a complicated issue, but we have two experts in studio now to share their thoughts. As we welcome UNF President and former Mayor John Delaney. Good morning. Always great to see you.
Good to see you.
And also with us, Dr. Mick Hallett of UNF's Criminology Department. Good morning.
Good morning.
And what are your questions about the pension situation in Jacksonville? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. We also welcome your Facebook comments. So, first off, President Delaney, former mayor of the city, what's your reaction to the move by the council president Yarbrough to delay this final vote? He's saying there are some issues with this reform package that warrant further review.
Well, there's some passivity on this by the executive branch, and so the city council's really had to do all the work. And I think just a little refresher, the way disputes with unions work out is they try to negotiate. If they can't come to an agreement, they go to an arbitrator. If they don't agree with the arbitrator, then they go to the city council, and the city council imposes it. It's called impasse. There's no appeal. That's it. And for 5 years, the city has tried to work on this issue. Mayor Payton had a resolution 4 years ago that Mayor Brown asked the city council to reject. And as a result, in the ensuing time, there's been a lot of myths and a few things that I think gets forgotten. One is that these are two really good departments. We tend to kind of obscure that. The public doesn't like anybody that works for the public to be paid any money or to have a defined benefit pension. They're very resented. Secondly, John Keene has really been pilloried, and I think very unfairly, and I know that Mick agrees with that as well. He's a good guy and a good man. But it's not an overly rich plan. People, again, hate pensions for people in the public, but the Times Union did a story, compared it to other cities in the state. It is on the low end. In fact, I think it was the lowest compared to other cities. That doesn't mean that it doesn't need to be fixed in the wake of the economy, though.
Let's talk about potential fixes, and the number to join the show is 549-2937. Mick Hallett, one candidate in the city's mayor's race, Bill Bishop, has said we need a half-cent sales tax to address this hundreds of millions of dollars of debt, or liability, I should say. Mayor Brown has a plan on the table that the council will vote on. It involves JEA being involved in addressing this. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I don't think either of those are too attractive, really. I think the JEA plan is, I think one of the things that will happen is if we ever manage to get out from under the police and fire pension fund debt, is that then our attention will turn to the general employees, of which JEA is a major part. And they're also, of course, largely insolvent, not as badly as the police and fire pension fund, but there are pension issues there as well. So I think we're in for a long, hard slog. Some people I saw in the comment section of the Times Union reporting on it, you know, that this was somehow, you know, undermining the pension debt, but they hadn't figured out a way to pay for it anyway. I mean, the pension deal. So I think we're still a long way out. And the reason I'm interested, I've studied public finance of criminal justice for almost 20 years. My stuff's been in privatization. But I don't think we've really had a thorough conversation about pension debt in Jacksonville even yet.
Well, I think the bottom line is that there's sort of a search for a unicorn, is what the Civic Council said, that they want this to be the bucket to be filled, but painlessly. And the bottom line is the projection is they need roughly $40 million a year for 10 years, along with these changes that, by and large, the fund has agreed with and or indicated that they've agreed with. And if that gets done, this is fixed. So the agreement here is it's a reduction in benefits for the employees. It saves about $1.2 billion over the next ensuing 30 years. But there needs to be about $40 million a year for 10 years to fill the bucket. The JA plan is really not viable. That's a backdoor tax. And
you don't think that'll pass the council?
I haven't heard any indication the council's interested in that. The JEA risks having its bonds downgraded. It is not as competitive as it was 10 years ago. So it's probably going to come around. It's either going to have to be a sales tax or a property tax increase in a commitment over a 10-year period.
And let us know, callers, would you be in favor of a tax increase to solve the city's pension issue? We'll go to the calls in just a moment at 549-2937. A UNF pullout this week from your own public opinion research lab found a half-cent sales tax increase or the other plan that's on the table are not winning issues with the public. The voters about evenly split whether they thought either one of those was a good idea. So politically, it's a hard sell no matter what you do, isn't it?
Yeah, but you know what's interesting about that poll, and Mick could weigh in on, the public, this is a low priority fixing the pension to the public.
It wasn't at the top of the public's list.
At the top of the list is crime.
Right.
And what I think, again, the our elected officials need to convey is that to dig, it's the $40 million a year, which is only 4% of the revenue of the city, but that $40 million's got to come from somewhere absent a new source, and that's going to come out of law enforcement. And already that's been underfunded, and we've already had a reduction in the number of patrolmen on the street, and so somehow the quality of life would be destroyed unless we can find a way to pay for this and get these concessions passed.
Yeah, Mick Hallett, people say their number one issue is the crime rate, but you can let's connect the dots and explain if we don't address pension,
yeah,
we will see almost likely an increase in crime and other quality of life indicators will go south.
Right. Well, as everyone from the sheriff to others have pointed out, that the defined benefit structure is the market and public safety. And I think the reality of it is that we also need to keep in mind is that crime in Jacksonville is very uniquely complex. In other words, we have led the state in homicide for, you know, well over a decade. We've got the highest rate of violent crime committed with firearms of any city in the state of Florida. So attracting law enforcement personnel, especially to the city of Jacksonville, is uniquely attractive. And as President Delaney said, the truth about the pension benefit structure is that we're really not overly generous. I think one of the concerning issues that we face in solving the pension crisis is that this myth of a $5 million cop, that cops are out there getting rich off their pension. What really happened there is they took the highest earners in the fund and pilloried them and made it look like the average take-home pay on a retired police officer is $5 million, which is the furthest from the truth.
That guy would have to live to age 95. He's had a couple of heart attacks. He's been in a bad accident.
Yeah.
The myth of the 20-year retiree, it's very rare somebody retires after 20 years. And if they do, they probably needed to. There's either, you know, psychological stress or physical stress. And the one that has just bothered from the beginning is that this was a 30-year agreement, that's what the deal was in 2001, which was back when I was in office. I've been gone 12 years now, but paragraphs 31 and 32 obviate that. They say that if there's a change in economic circumstances, then we can reduce benefits.
How do you think that myth took hold?
Well, because that's the storyline that the unions have labeled it, and the media's picked it up, and you've picked it up. The Times Union's picked it up.
It's my fault.
it's just frustrating that's been allowed to take hold. And the union or the pension fund knows it's not a 30-year agreement. There's no lawyer that's looked at it that says the pension benefits aren't in play.
Well,
they've had a pretty good agreement.
I've heard John Keane give voice to that. Many times.
He will privately to me say, hey, it gives us some leverage. And what it's done is it's frozen the city for the last 5 years to fix the thing. Should have just been imposed.
And we want to know right now, where do you stand on a possible tax increase, a sales tax increase, a property tax increase to address Jacksonville's huge pension hole? We'll go to your calls in just a moment at 549-2937. Ryan tweets the show, it's not the only step we need to take, but I'm in favor of a half-cent sales tax. Then we can focus on bigger issues. Mick Hallady says that's not the only step we need to take. Would a half-cent sales tax solve it, or would that just be one step on the road to solving it?
I don't really like the sales tax option. I think we ought to preserve our sales tax for bigger issues like better Jacksonville-level kinds of programs. I mean, to me, we need a millage increase right now as the fiscally conservative response to the pension crisis. We've got many other crises. I mean, the police and fire pension fund crisis is not the only pension fund crisis facing this city, but there are also imploding infrastructure issues and other kinds of fiscal
concerns. You've talked about that for years, that we have the lowest millage rate of any major Florida city.
Of any peer-sized city,
any,
absolutely.
Any city of our comparable size.
Right. And that's changed a little bit, though. It's we're now a lot more competitive, especially if you include the revenue that comes from the JEA, which is in effect the equivalent of a tax. And look, I think Mick and I, not to speak for Mick, we're just a messenger on this. Nobody wants a tax increase. Yeah. But the only way to deal with this, it hasn't been appropriately funded the last 12 years. And if it $30 million a year, if that had been done, we wouldn't have this hole along with these concessions that are being made. And I know when I run into a cop or a firefighter, they want this done. They're sick of it. Yeah. They want to have some stability. The departments want to be able to hire and be predictable in terms of what you're going to pay your people.
549-2937, what are your thoughts this morning? Bill in Mandarin. Hi, Bill. Good morning. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I think part of the problem is the absolute absence of quantitative discussion by the city council. We know roughly that for every delay a month on this, it grows by $10 million, the obligation. That's because of the 7 to 7.5%. But when Mr. Yarbrough said, okay, let's delay the discussion here, he did not say what it was he wanted to do and assess what the cost was. For example, we delay a month. All right, that's $10 million bucks. This is plan that he wants going to cost or save us $10 million bucks. That kind of detail now is woefully absent.
Well, I think they've done a really good job of digging into this. And what has changed in the last couple of weeks is mortality tables. In other words, the prediction of how long people are going to change every 10 to 15 years, those are updated, and life expectancy extended. So when you do an actuarial study, all of a sudden the hole's bigger because people are living longer and you have to pay longer. And I commend the city council for what they've done. They have done a remarkable job of digging into the details. It's all in the public. Everything has been in the sunshine. Every meeting has been in the sunshine. And I think Clay just wants to kind of say, okay, do we really know what the hole is?
What do you think of critics of the move who think it's a political move, a way to delay the mayor's much hoped for victory on this issue?
Well, this has been a city council action. It's been, the mayor's proposal has been rejected twice, and so they've gone back to have significant changes. They've in effect taken over the negotiations with the pension fund. So I don't see it as a ploy. I think they really are serious about trying to fix this thing.
549-2937. Ben on the south side. Hello, Ben. Good morning.
I'm doing good. Quick question. I know they were planning on dredging the river, and that was going to cost upwards of $300 million. Where's that money coming from?
Oh, that's another big question, isn't it? Yeah. Thank you, Ben. Yeah. Mick Hallett, that is another huge obligation, financial obligation, that if it goes through, the city would also have to take on it.
Indeed. I'm the furthest guy you want to ask anything about the river, but I would just point out in response to that in the scheme of things, the pension fund crisis ought not to be taking us so long to resolve. It's not that much money in terms of the $40 million a year that they need to fund a reasonable proposal. And as for the city council, there's a lot of theatrics right now because we're entering election and all. And I don't see that as a major. That's more theater than having a real impact. But absolutely, if there are things that we want to do to be a great city, we need to get beyond this pension crisis.
John Delaney.
Well, the reminder that when the recession kicked in 07, 08, 09, Mayor Payton had a proposal that is along the lines of what's on the table right now. And so even when this is passed, what this does is kind of fill a billion-plus dollar bucket. We still have to find a funding source that has been shorted for the last dozen years to come up with roughly $400 million. That gets this thing to a healthy status.
We'll go to your emails and tweets in just a moment as we speak with UNF President John Delaney and UNF Professor Mick Hallett on the city's pension issue. Where do you stand on, as what some say is necessary, a tax increase to address this problem? 549-2937. Patty in Mandarin is on the line. Hello, Patty. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Thanks for calling.
Okay, a couple of things. First of all, that JEA plan is exactly what somebody said it was. It's a backdoor tax. So if we're going to tax somebody, let's do it on the front and open and call it a tax. And then second of all, everyone who pays a sales tax is also being protected by the firemen, by the policemen. So let's stop picking on the property owners. They just had their rates raised about 14% not too long ago. So let's let other people put in and pay their fair share, okay?
So you'd be more in favor of a sales tax, Patty, is that right?
Spread it out more evenly. Let the community pay for its protection.
Patty, thanks for the call. Mick Hallett.
Yeah, I think the challenge with the property tax, of course, is it requires a referendum. And, you know, myths like $1 million cops don't lend much support, you know, on the part of the public
for property tax hike.
Yeah, or a sales tax hike. I think the way to do it is to raise the millage rate. We have been historically low, and there are great economies of scale with the consolidated government. People need to celebrate that and get over the pension crisis.
Yeah, I think really it comes down to picking your poison. If you're in retail, you won't want a sales tax increase. If you have a lot of real estate, you're not going to want a property tax increase. And the property tax, they could sort of carve out a half a mil or four-tenths of a mil and sort of carve it, but that has to be voted on every year, and the hope would be that future councils would do that while still maintaining a property tax rate that allows appropriate services to be done. And Mick has pointed out we've got a lot of holes. We're not fixing potholes right now.
Yeah, exactly, including one in my neighborhood.
There you go.
Meyer tweets the show, before I take a tax increase for the pension issue, the politicians need to explain exactly that the new tax will fix it. Mabel tweets the show, this may be ironic or topic, but not consider legalizing medical marijuana and using that revenue for the pension payback. A lot of creative solutions out there today. Here's an email from Steve. I'm wondering whether the average citizen would pay more or less if a half-cent sales tax increase were adopted as opposed to the property tax increase that would give the city the same annual revenue needed to pay the debt down. I understand that in addition to the JEA payment option, both types of tax increases are options before the council, but most public discussion mentions sales tax only. According to the Times Union, a 1.5 mil increase in the property tax would produce the equivalent revenue.
Yeah, there's a couple things on the JEA. The JEA is only about a third of the bucket, and so the city would still need to come up with another $120 million that it does not have, and then they're double counting a $60 million that the fund would get from some excess chapter monies. And the advantage of a sales tax is that a quarter of it is paid by people that don't live in Duval County, you know, tourists and people from the surrounding counties
sure.
that work here. But it's I'm sort of agnostic at this point in time on that, other than as the Civic Council has represented, a source has to be declared or else we're just going to be eating into the seed corn on how to run the city day to day.
Here's an email from William in downtown Jacksonville, a question for President Delaney. Our pension problem is decades in the making. What role do you think you played? And looking back, what do you think you could have done differently when you were mayor?
Well, I just disagree with that. The fund was actuarially funded when I left and was healthy. The problem was that there was lack of deposits made in the ensuing 30 years. And secondly, the benefit changes that needed to go in that Mayor Payton proposed were just thrown aside. And then we've been negotiating for 4 years. And so this hole could have been fixed back in 08, 09. And Mayor Payton had a plan to do it.
Here's an email from another listener. I'm trying to understand.
And the benefits, I know I'm interrupting you. Yeah. The benefits that were agreed to in 01 were completely reasonable and affordable for the time. But when there's changed economic circumstances, which is in the agreement, mm-hmm. you've got to negotiate those down, as has happened all across the country. And it just wasn't, Mayor Brown rejected Mayor Payton's proposal.
Here's an email from Don. I'm trying to understand why citizens are responsible for an error in the math performed by the folks downtown. Would making those responsible for their own retirement help decrease the issue?
That falls to me.
yes.
I don't think there was an error in the math. I think there was a fiscal crisis that affected the whole city. I think historically, because of consolidation, the millage rate and civic infrastructure has been funded creatively. Property values increased during Mayor Delaney's tenure. So I think a series of strokes of bad luck and sort of political intransigence. I think the fiscally conservative way out of this crisis now to save taxpayer money, they need to raise the millage rate. That's the most direct way to solve the problem.
And I want to get just a reminder, too, that you know, post 9/11, the unions for police and fire had an awful lot of strength. And as the fund fell into or out of the funded level, 80% is the threshold. As it fell below that, the city council twice added benefits in the beginning of the fiscal crisis. And the hole, they kept digging it in and then weren't funding it. And the bottom line is, we could have paid then, or we got to pay now. And I know that you know, we're getting the benefits of the police and the fire in this community, two very, very good departments. It is not an overly rich plan. I know people don't like hearing that because they don't like seeing people retiring with a with a defined benefit pension. But it's not an overly rich plan compared to the other departments.
One thing we point out a lot on this program too is the police, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I know the police don't draw Social Security, and I don't think the firefighters
do. No, they don't.
Either.
No city employees. Does.
Yeah.
And so that's the other thing that gets lost in this discussion is the reason the plan is different than state's plan or some other community's plan is that the retirees can get Social Security benefits, and that doesn't happen. So the money that the employer would put into Social Security should go to the pension plan, and it just wasn't funded appropriately.
And we've got calls from the South Side, Bay Meadows, the Beaches, and Dale in Jacksonville is on the line. Hi, Dale. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Oh, yeah. Well, my father-in-law retired from JEA, or JTA, rather, and his pension was nothing compared to what it is today. But let me ask you a question on something like this here. We're getting a lot of construction. Did I lose you?
So we're here.
No, you're good to go.
Okay. We're getting a lot of construction, like at Commonwealth and Pritchard and all these things. We're widening the roads and all that, but I see a lot of things that we're doing over and over and over, spending thousands and hundreds and thousands of dollars, that why not look at what we're doing and then 5 years down the road, destroying $100,000 we just put in there and redoing it all over again. Isn't that being cost effective?
Thanks, Dale.
Yeah, there's a big overlap. The federal government does roads, the state government does roads, the city does roads, and the JTA does roads.
And is that smart?
It's the way it is. I've always been frustrated that you get a new road done, and then the cable company's out there tearing it up, and then they patch
sure.
it, and then the phone company's out there, and then the sewer, you know, the JEA to do some storm sewers. But yeah, the idea is to try to coordinate it. That was one of the themes of the Better Jacksonville plan, was to get all of that underground work coordinated. And I think it went pretty well until the recession hit, until there was just a collapse.
Rick at the Beaches has some thoughts. Good morning, Rick. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Has anyone worked on any figures if we, the millage rate or even the sales tax, what it would cost an individual? Are we talking less than $100 a year or more than $100 a year?
Yeah, sure. Great question, Rick. Let's explain what this would mean for the average citizen.
Well, I think I thought I saw somewhere an analysis that said it would be on average about $150 a year for the sort of median property owner. I mean, one issue and
what about and a sales tax you wouldn't really notice per se
right.
in your day to day
life.
But
of course, the challenge with the sales tax is you got to have a referendum
yes.
on it first, and so who knows when that'll kick in or if it will. Meanwhile, as someone pointed out, the debt is escalating. I think that there's another sort of home rule issue that affects us here in Florida, in Jacksonville, that under Governor Bush and then again under Charlie Crist, there was a cap put on how much localities could raise taxes. So that's also factored in.
Well, really what they did was put a limitation on the valuation that you would tax of homes.
Right.
So right now a mill of property taxes raises far less per $100,000 of house than it did 6, 7, 8 years ago. And it's one of the things that has always frustrated me is that the legislature, and I'll point fingers at both governors, and Governor Bush is a good friend of mine, is that they could claim a tax cut without having to pay for it because they made somebody else do it. And if Congress had said to Florida, you know, you're raising too much sales tax money off the 100 million tourists that come to the state, we're going to cap your ability to fund the state, we'd be seceding from the union. And localities just didn't have that benefit. And Mick's point is very, very correct.
One more call. It's Valerie on the South Side this morning. Hello, Valerie. Go ahead.
Hi. Okay. This is a problem that the Republicans have started. Start raising taxes on the rich, and you'll find your money for the pension crisis and a lot more. This is why we need a democracy.
Valerie, thanks for the call.
Well, the rich that have the more expensive houses would pay more on a property tax, and the rich that spend more would pay more in sales tax. And
that's true.
You know, what you prefer is a progressive tax where it's scaled up for the, you know, the richer people are. In this case, it's because of what you purchase or what you own. Local government only has the ability really to move on the property tax and occasionally the sales tax for certain things. There's no income tax at the local level.
You were successful in getting that referendum through for the Better Jacksonville plan. That's always a heavy lift,
that
right?
That was for capital. In other words, that was for structures and buildings and roads and bike paths and land acquisition.
Things people could see, touch, get their arms
Correct.
Around.
It wasn't for operations. Now, it took a huge stress off the operational budget for the city because the city didn't have money to fix the libraries or build a library or build the new baseball park. The Coliseum was falling apart. Downtown library falling apart. Didn't have money to widen the roads that have been widened all across this county that have made our commute significantly better than it otherwise would have been. And then the environmental improvements that came. But it wasn't operations.
And so let's close with Mick Hallett. Your final thoughts about this?
Well, and just, look at the cost of not fully funding an adequate civic infrastructure. Look at the cost to the city of not having a good quality of life. Look at the mess we're in right now with, escalating debt out of control with no clear plan to resolve it. That can't be good. That's not good for rich or poor.
Well, it's always fascinating to welcome you both. Thank you both so much for giving us your time today.
Thank you, Melissa.
We were joined by UNF President John Delaney and UNF's Mick Hallett discussing the city's pension situation. A vote on that set for tonight at the City Council has been delayed, but we'll continue to follow it here at 89.9. Much more still ahead. Meantime, later in the hour, why the Blood Alliance needs your help. Plus, we'll tell you about their unique partnership. But up next, Going Green profiles the unique horticulture of the city's jewel, the Cummer Museum. That's right after this.
Who will be Jacksonville's next mayor? Where do the candidates stand on the issues affecting the First Coast, such as pensions, taxes, public health and safety, downtown development, and the city's human rights ordinance? WJCT has teamed up with First Coast News and the Florida Times Union to present Jacksonville 2015. The first debate with mayoral candidates Alvin Brown, Bill Bishop, and Lenny Curry. Jacksonville 2015, Thursday night at 7 on WJCT Public Television.
I called him the Candyman.
Staffers knew what a VA doctor was up to, but no one was listening.
I said that your own chief of psychiatry hands out narcotics like they're candy. And the director, sat back in his chair and, laughed.
Next time on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Sunday at 1 on WJCT 89.9.
WJCT's Travel and Entertainment Auction is where you'll find over 300 items, most starting at 75% off at auction.wjct.org. Packages include lodging, attractions, dining, recreation, beauty, and more. Bid now. The auction continues through March 16th at 9 p.m. Log on to auction.wjct.org for more information.
The Florida Legislature is in session, and Capitol Report is your nightly connection to what's happening in Tallahassee as lawmakers debate and decide issues that affect all Floridians, such as expanding health care and gambling, protecting the state's water resources, private versus public schools, and prison reform. Hear Capitol Report each weeknight during the legislative session on this Florida Public Radio station.
Weeknights at 6:30 on WJCT 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, this month, the Cummer Museum welcomes the president of the famed Brooklyn Botanic Garden. Scott Mebry will discuss how to guide the cultural institution to continue its commitment to education, research, and the display of horticulture. Remember, it's the Cummer Museum of Art and Gardens. Scott Mebry's on the line now with a preview in today's Going Green. Hi, Scott. Good morning.
Good morning from Brooklyn.
All right, and good to have you on the phone from Brooklyn. Have you ever seen our Cummer Museum of Art and Gardens before?
I haven't, and I'm so excited about coming, not only because there's still snow on the ground, but I'm very excited to read about it.
Well, you're in for a treat.
Wonderful.
Not only is the museum gorgeous, but the gardens are second to none, and they're right on the water. It really is a stunning place to visit. And we're so curious to hear a little bit about your talk. Now, of course, you're president of the famed Brooklyn Botanic Garden. That is a jewel in New York. Absolutely stunning. What secrets will you be sharing with listeners when you come to visit our Cummer Museum?
Well, I think one of sort of the most distinctive elements of Brooklyn Botanic Garden, now at 105 years old, is that we created a new model for botanic gardens in the world by putting youth environmental education sort of at the forefront. And by 1912, we had hired a cadre of teacher trainers that were out in the schools in the borough. 1914, we opened the first children's garden in a botanic garden in the world, something we celebrated the centennial of last year. And this spring, we open a fabulous discovery garden for children and families to do just drop-in programming. So I'm very eager to share what we've learned about working with casual visitors and seeing if there's some, you know, models that might make sense at Cummer as well.
What sort of models and what sort of lessons have you learned?
Well, you know, we work with sort of all age groups. So we a lot with, you know, even toddlers and things, and that the Discovery Garden is particularly popular with that age group. We have very robust school programs for elementary kids, and we're out in the schools as well as bringing a lot of school workshops. We have specialized facilities, which are really kind of clever. They have tables that are on a hydraulic lift that raise and lower to the height of the children that you're working with, so that's very functional. You might have kindergartners or fifth graders. It all works well. We have a really wonderful middle school leadership program that draws from all five boroughs, and that's been particularly interesting because the middle school audience is said to be a difficult one for cultural institutions to work with. Kids, you know, hard to get them focused and working together. And then we have an environmental science high school that we created across the street from the garden with 500 students that claim the campus, you know, garden as part of the campus. And so in all of those elements, there's things that are really interesting. If we want an environmentally literate citizenry in the future, we've got to sort of create them by inspiring kids about nature and plants.
And, it is remarkable how the next generation of kids is so tuned into environmental issues and sustainability. How important is that to your work, bringing those to the forefront?
It really underpins everything we do. And so, you know, at our age and maturity, you know, we've got some things that we've got to correct. And one of the big ones is about water. And so we've got a lot of projects underway. We opened a gold visitor center 2 years ago that has won 20 awards, including American Architecture's highest honor, the National Honor Award from the AIA. And that really kind of exhibits or, you know, sort of represents our commitment to sustainability. It's got a lot of dimensions that are really quite interesting, and we interpret them. The water project is wonderful. It's not only going to save 21 million gallons of fresh water a year, it also addresses a problem with stormwater that is not unique to New York. It's found in a lot of communities in the United States.
And you've done all this in a really tight urban environment. The climate down here is different, the geography.
Yeah.
When you look at Florida, what do you see?
You know, it's been a little while since I've been. You know, I grew up in Hawaii, and actually I used to come to South Florida because we had a lot of analogs in plants and things. So I think the sort of the coastal, you know, connection is something that we share. We're pretty close to the harbor here in Brooklyn. And so, you know, we might be a little bit more elevated site, but I think things related to climate change and especially to sea level rise possibly and other things, salt intrusion and planting in a way that allow us to deal with both catastrophic freeze or periodic sort of flooding and things are things that we all need to sort of plan for. So I think that's changing our sort of long-term thinking about planting, really.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that, how the kinds of plants we choose and nurture can help mitigate against sea level rise and coastal erosion and such?
Really, salt tolerance is a really big thing. And we discovered that after, you know, Superstorm Sandy here in New York, where in some neighborhoods, you know, all the street trees died because they just were not tolerant of the seawater. And yet there are a lot of plants that would be. So, you know, you might just be choosing plants assuming that that's going to happen again. And so that's one very practical choice in terms of a street tree planting. But there would be other dimensions that you might think about, you know, standing water. I think that was a finding, in, you know, certainly in Katrina, where the water was up for a long time and a lot of trees died. But a lot of trees that were tolerant of that didn't. They were fine. And so they were you know, tolerant of both, you know, periodic drought as well as, you know, high water.
In the wake of Sandy in New York, you know, of course, it hit New York and New Jersey so hard. Have people started making those changes?
I think it's, and we've got a big community environmental horticulture program, and so we've been advocating for this. And we think that there, you know, and part of that is just the sensible kind of turn in part to using native plants that are in, you know, generally, in many cases, tolerant of the kind of conditions we're discussing. And so I think, yes, that's true. You know, it's very interesting when we talk about Sandy. We have a little survivor's guilt because the garden here, our 52 acres, not so badly hit, but it wasn't very far from us where a lot of our, you know, colleagues and neighbors, you know, were really pretty heavily hit up by the storm. Not an unfamiliar phenomenon in Florida, I'm sure.
Well, it's sure to be a fascinating talk. And as you said, you've got snow on the ground up there. So, Scott, I hope the weather holds out for you when you come down here.
Thank you. Well, spring is springing. We have our first crocus and snowdrops as of yesterday. So, and the, you know, the weather's back, maybe nearly 60 degrees here in New York. So we're very excited. It's finally happening.
Excellent. Well, enjoy your time in Florida. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Scott Medbury is the president of the famed Brooklyn Botanic Garden. He'll give a lecture and be part of a luncheon at the Kummer Museum on Wednesday, March 25th. From 11 to 1, registration is required. Just go to kummer.org to get your seat. And we're back in a moment.
This Going Green segment brought to you by Bug Out Service.
WJCTnews.org is your source for the latest local, national, and international news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Podcasts of your favorite local stories and shows, the WJCT First Read every weekday morning, and playlists from all of our after-hours music programming. From your computer or mobile device, see it all at WJCTnews.org.
Congratulations to writer James English, winner of the first quarter of The Square. Now it's your chance to show off your art, whether it's music, visual art, sculpture, poetry, and more. Go to wjct.org/The Square, check out the amazing local talent, and submit your work now.
When a mama and daddy moved into the house across the street.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama declared Venezuela a national security threat and ordered sanctions against 7 of its top officials. What's behind escalating tensions between the two countries and prospects for improved relations?
Weekdays at 10, right after First Coast Connect on 89.9 FM WJCT.
Looking for something different musically? Listen to After Hours weeknights at 7 on 89.9 FM, from classical to country.
Give me a word, give me a sign. Show me where to look and tell me what will I find. What will I find? Lay me on the ground, fly me in the sky. Show me where to look and tell me what will I find. What will I find?
Travel back in time with Radio Theater, Doo-Wop Revival, The Great American Songbook, and Juke Joint. Throwback Sundays, Sunday nights beginning at 7 on 89.9 WJZT. Looking forward to looking back.
Welcome back, and finally this hour. Right now, we need to tell you why this month you really need to support the Blood Alliance, Northeast Florida's only provider of blood to all area hospitals. And this month, with just one pint of blood you donate, you can help save up to 3 lives and also give the gift of a dream to 2 children at Jacksonville's Dreams Come True. That's 5 lives affected by your one blood donation this month. Here's how. We're welcoming right now Odette Stroys, Communications and Public Relations Director with the Blood Alliance. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And Sherry Criswell, Executive Director of Dreams Come True.
Good morning.
Ladies, great to see you. Odette, this is a unique partnership. What's it all about?
Well, we felt a very strong alignment with Dreams Come True because they're local, and so are we, and they serve local children in Duval County, and we're the only provider of blood, so there was a good enrichment opportunity. Mm-hmm. And what we basically doing is if you come in and give us a pint of blood, we'll give Dreams Come True a dollar. If you return 50 hero rewards points, these are points you get for giving blood. You can collect them and exchange them for gifts on our online hero rewards store. But if you return them to us, 50 points gives Dreams Come True $5. So it's going to be a wonderful way to enrich two beautiful lives. And I'm sure Sherry will tell you about the two dreamers. But more importantly, come in and give blood, save those three lives with your one pint, and then affect an enrichment experience with two dreamers.
Absolutely. Last year alone, we were able to provide dreams for 156 local children. And this year we have two special children that we're going to serve as a result of this partnership. And so we're just really excited.
Let's talk a little bit about the mission of Dreams Come True. For people
sure.
that haven't heard of you, it's a wonderful organization.
I am partial, but I agree. we have the privilege of serving every single child in this community who is diagnosed with something life-threatening. And we work with the local community through Wolfson Children's Hospital, Nemours, Brooks Rehab, and the University of Florida to identify those children. And they're all entitled to a dream. And so it's a really great opportunity for kids who are just going through something very difficult to have a light at the end of the tunnel.
And you've got a couple of kids you want to tell us about.
Well, yes, we are going to be able to provide a couple of dreams, one in particular to Give Kids the World, which is an all-inclusive resort just for children with life-threatening illnesses in Orlando. And this child will be able to go there for 7 days and enjoy all the parks, a 3-day park hopper to the Disney parks, 2 days to Islands of Adventure, Universal, and also 1 day to SeaWorld, plus any other thing they want to do there. And so it's all inclusive, and it's going to be a wonderful VIP opportunity, front of the lines and all that.
And you've fulfilled all kinds of dreams, haven't you? What are some of the more unique ones?
Well, we absolutely... recently, one of the dreams we fulfilled was Bill Clinton. We had a young man who wanted to meet Bill Clinton because of his global initiative involving childhood cancer research. And so we were able to get him a meet and greet with Bill Clinton. It turned out to be just a really wonderful thing for this young man who just had a really unique dream.
Oh, how exciting. And so, Odette, this is an easy way to help two incredibly valuable nonprofits mm-hmm. on the First Coast.
Local ones.
100%. With a simple act of giving blood.
Yeah, and the alignment is just so amazing because Dreams Come True is 100% local. So anything that they do, it goes directly to the children. And we feel that because any blood you give us goes directly to serve your fellow Jacksonvillian, St. Augustinian. We're in the whole of the Northeast Florida area and the only provider of blood. And, we have peaks and valleys, and I would say we're in a canyon right now because we have very low blood supply. We need those O's, A's, and B's to come in, and we really, really need you to. And, March is going to be a terrific time to come in because, again, you're not only saving lives with your blood donation, you're also going to change lives and impact the life of two children. Katie is 15. She has a brain tumor. Mm-hmm. She's blind as a result mm-hmm. of that. And little Jaquan is 12 years old, and he has osteosarcoma, and he's in hospital. So we really want you to come out, help these two kids realize their dreams by a blood donation. So it's just that simple. It's a pinprick. That's all we're asking you to come in, enjoy a good snack. You get a free physical at the same time. So, what more can we ask for, to save a life? You can choose to be a pint-sized superhero. I love that.
What would you say to people who are listening and they say to themselves, yeah, I know I need to do that? We say the same thing to people during our pledge drives.
Right.
I've just never gotten around to it.
Well, don't wait. This is your choice to be a hero. You can run into a building that's burning and pull someone out. Here you can save five lives, impact five different lives with just an hour of your time. Choose to be that hero today. Don't sit on the couch. Get up. Do it. Because you know what? It could be someone you know. It could even be your own life that's impacted by it.
Let's explain how that one, how one pint of blood helps someone who needs blood.
Well, your blood is made up of three major components. You have red blood cells, plasma, and platelets. And when you give us your whole blood, we break it down into those three different components, and they serve three different people. In 7 minutes of drawing blood, your one pint will impact up to three different lives. Think about it, folks. I mean, you could be that hero for three different people, a family that's falling down on their knees in a hospital somewhere, hoping that the right blood type is there to match their patient. You know, don't wait.
And as you said, you have peaks and valleys, but right now...
We're in a canyon.
You are in a canyon. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, you know, we need all kinds of blood. And, you know, typically people have busy schedules and they think, well, someone else is going to come in and donate. And that's really what the case is. We just need you to think, no, I have to be the one to come in and donate. So please come in. Don't wait. Go to igiveblood.com, set up your appointment and come in. And, you know, I mean, it just takes an hour of your time to be a hero for...
Yeah.
This month, five people.
And people might not realize the Blood Alliance is the blood supplier for all of the hospitals
the
in our area.
The only one. That's right. We're the only blood provider for all hospitals. So no matter who is in the hospital right now, they're getting their blood from the Blood Alliance. This is the only source. And we can't make blood. You can't harvest it. We depend on you. And we depend on the community to come in. So if you're listening in right now, it's you I'm talking to say, you know, please go to igiveblood.com, come in and help dreams come true this month. It'll be fantastic. But not only that, become a lifetime donor as well and help your fellow man. You never know when it could be even yourself.
That's right. And Sherry Kurzweil, you're giving people a really nice incentive this month, just this month, right, to come and support dreams come true.
Absolutely. And we hope you will come out and just, as you said, affect five different lives with one gift.
You have a blood drive this afternoon at Dreams
Come
True.
We do. I'm giving myself at 2:30 today. The blood mobile will be at our office on South Point Parkway, and I understand we have some slots left there, so you can actually do it today.
Let's tell people where exactly they need to go.
Well, today we're at 6803 South Point Parkway. We are about a little less than a mile north of Belfort Road, where the hospital connects there. So it's convenient. And anytime after 2 o'clock, you can drop by.
Yeah. And you don't need an appointment.
No, you
just
don't.
Come on by. The blood mobile is such a brilliant thing. It's parked right outside of our offices, and we've donated. It's pretty convenient.
We do, and this promotion does affect blood mobiles, so you've got to jump on a blood mobile to help dreams come true. But if you're not giving blood and you're in the deferral period, or you know you're waiting for your time in between, you can give your points back. So please make sure you give your points back. 50 hero reward points returned to the hero rewards store online will give dreams come true $5. So we're really excited to help these two dreamers.
And it is really unbelievable that you're going to support two dreams with this drive. It's an exciting time for dreams come true.
And they have till the end of March, but of course you want donors every day of the year.
Absolutely. The thing about giving blood people don't realize is not like when you give money to a charity and you say, I've done my deed. Your blood's used. By the time you've already finished giving it, it's going to be used. It has a shelf life, and that's what people need to remember. Your most important donation is the next one. So platelets can live for about 4 or 5 days. I mean, that's it. So, you know, that's a really short-term turnaround, because you also have to test the blood to make sure it's okay before we put it on the shelf, and that takes about a day and a half. So it's a really short turnaround time, and we hope people who give blood do come back. If you have a tattoo, don't tell me you're afraid of needles. I want you to come in. Those tattooed folks that with ink on you, I want to see all of you guys come
in. That's right. So come on out today from 2 to 6 to Dreams Come True on South Point Parkway. Just walk right on up to the Bloodmobile. They'll let you in. You can donate on the spot or find any location around town. And visit the Blood Alliance. The website is igiveblood.com. That's igiveblood.com. Just one pint will help five lives this month. A great promotion. What a partnership. Odette and Sherry, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Odette Stroy is Communications and Public Relations Director with the Blood Alliance. And also with us today, Sherry Kurzweil, Executive Director of Dreams Come True. Give blood today. And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. The show's producer is Sean Birch. Our show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. If you've got any feedback about the show, we always want to hear it. Just drop an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to catch our daily podcasts. They are now up every day on iTunes. Next on Diane Rehm, President Obama declared Venezuela a national security threat and ordered sanctions against seven of its top officials. Ahead, a look at what's behind escalating tensions between the two countries and prospects for improved relations. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.